Today, I'm really pleased and excited to welcome to my blog David Vandergrift. Now, David is an attorney, an entrepreneur, a former tech executive, and a writer. And you probably have never heard his name. You may know David as the passive guy because he has a very popular and well-traveled blog called The Passive Voice, and that's one of the things we're going to talk about today. So, hi, David. Welcome, and thank you very much for taking time out of your day. I'm sure you're pretty busy.
It's great to talk to you, Joel. Never too busy for you.
Well, that's very nice. So, I want to get right into the whole thing about the blogging part of your current activities, because I think that's really fascinating. As a blogger myself, it's really interesting to see all the different ways that people come up with to create blogs. And there's certainly lots of different models, and I write about this stuff a lot. And you are a kind of a content curator in a sense. So my question to you was, at the time you started the Passive Voice, you were working as an attorney, yeah?
I was using my legal skills in a with a company that I started and managed that acquired patents and then went through the process of licensing those patents and generating patent royalties from them. And so I was not formally practicing law at the time, but I was using my legal background with patent licensing and patent litigation.
Okay, so because you were active legally, you said on your blog, because I was reading your about page, that you started the blog anonymously and nobody knew who this guy was. All of a sudden there was just like this person in the blogosphere talking about publishing contracts and the disruptive influences in the publishing industry. And he was just the passive guy, which is kind of a cool nickname. And the Passive Voice is like a great brand. And people got onto your blog really fast. They just loved it. And you were posting a lot of stuff. So it seemed like that influenced a lot of your traffic. And then it all changed. Like you went from being an anonymous blogger to coming out. So why don't you tell us what happened there?
Well, the reason for the anonymity was, as I think I mentioned at least in a previous about page, is because I was my company was involved in litigation. I didn't want to have wise guy comments that I made on the blog quoted back to me in depositions, or if I was in court testifying in patent litigation, and so I wanted to keep a low profile so that opposing counsel couldn't easily connect me up with the passive voice via Google. As I say, I was trying to anticipate. I've done a lot of litigation previously, and that's what I would have done if I were the other side. And so I tried to make it a little more difficult for them to find my alter ego on the passive voice.
Yeah, Google has many uses, doesn't it?
It does. It does. There are fewer secrets than there used to be.
So I think you referred to those as snarky comments, and obviously in your blogging style, where you're reposting pieces from other people's articles and then sometimes commenting on them. I mean, a lot of people started reading your blog, I think, because of those snarky comments. That was like a big attraction. Well, let's see what the passive guy has to say about this.
Yeah, right.
And
Well, it's fun to do, and I certainly there are in today's publishing and self-publishing world, there are plenty of people and organizations that are deserving of a little snark from time to time, I believe.
so there you were doing patent litigation, and obviously you have a big background in intellectual property law. But you started a blog about the publishing business specifically. So how did that happen? I mean, have you ever published? Are you a published author? I mean, what was it about the publishing industry that attracted you? Because it seems like from your background, you could have gone in several different directions.
Well, I am a published author. Nothing very big or profitable or significant, I don't think. But my wife has also been an author for quite a number of years, And I started, you know, as with many authors, she was disappointed with the direction her royalties were going. And so I started doing a little bit of looking into self-publishing, decided to blog about it, was able to negotiate with my wife's publishers a return of rights for several of her books. And the Passive Voice was really sort of my way of blogging about what I was discovering about self-publishing. And I didn't find right away, I didn't find a lot of places that really talked about it in the way, you know, talked about the things that I was interested in. And then because I'm a lawyer, and because you know, the contracts between publishers and authors are so let's say interesting, I sort of gravitated into occasionally talking about publishing contracts and contract clauses and problems with contract clauses, and then discussing some litigation that's going on in the publishing world from time to time as well.
So, in fact, just continue on that. I mean, you have been collecting contracts. I mean, you have a contract collection service where you accept contracts. You kind of treat them anonymously so people aren't identified with whose contracts they are. Are you amassing a pretty big collection of contracts that way? Or are people sending you contracts?
Yes, people are sending me contracts. And one of the reasons I started the contract collection is as I got into this, the way I learn about an industry, and I've written contracts and negotiated contracts for a lot of different industries in my legal and business career. The way you learn about, you know, sort of how things are done is you try to see a lot of existing contracts, and you get a sense of the way people like to do things. You get a sense of how people like to hide gotchas. And so from that standpoint, it was, you know, that was the reason I tried to collect contracts, is it gave me an ability to fairly quickly understand how, you know, how publishers and agents structured their contracts, where they tried to gain advantages, where they did try to hide some things that some authors are not likely to see.
Well, it seems like probably the big change lately is all the e-publishing rights, digital rights. You know, and I remember I had a publishing company, a small publishing company years ago, and you know, all of those rights were really almost kind of like afterthoughts. Nobody really cared. I mean, there were some CD-ROM products, but basically, you know, nobody was doing anything with them. So it was very much an afterthought. Sometimes they were added into the contract. Sometimes they weren't. They just weren't even in there at all. So right. I assume that's like a big focus of the change that's going on now, because obviously eventually publishers did wake up to the fact that there was something valuable there.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And in any business contract, you pay most attention to the things that are going to generate dollars or other benefits to you for the contract. And when print was 99.9% of all revenues for book sales, then publishers didn't pay much attention to ebook rights. And then they as ebooks became more important sort of structurally, and again, I've dealt with enough contracts over the years to kind of get a pretty good idea of how things operate. Mm-hmm. And how contracts are modified over time. And initially, there were quite a few publishers that sort of just tacked on ebook rights without thinking much about how those rights and those contract clauses would interact with other clauses in the contract. And so, of course, as ebooks have become more and more of a significant profit center, then it's been interesting to see the publishers' contracts evolve over time, so that, you know, the contracts that my clients are getting today are substantially different in terms of ebook rights in many cases than the same publisher was proposing a couple of years ago.
Mm-hmm. Well, that is not surprising somehow. And right. You know, it seems like that, you know, I don't get into those areas very much because I kind of tend to stay on the indie side of the world.
Right.
Just that's my niche. And but it does seem like they're, for people signing contracts like that, they have to be very concerned with the possible scenarios under which those rights will revert back to them at some time, because it's a whole different world. You know, it was very easy to know if your book was out of print in the old days because it just was out of print. And now it's all quite a bit more amorphous. I mean, when does a print-on-demand book actually go out of print? You know, it's realistically, in the real world, it's never out of print, so you have to have some other kind of criteria, and the same could be said for ebooks too. So I assume that there's been a lot of evolution from both sides of that equation on how to deal with reversion of rights, particularly.
Yeah, you're right. You're correct on that. And basically, the reversion of rights or out of print clauses that most publishers are proposing in their standard contracts are essentially never out of print clauses.
Yeah.
It's the only way under the standard forms that the author will ever receive rights back under these clauses and clauses, and they're very complex and they're very obscure and so forth. But the only way that the author is ever going to receive rights back under these clauses in their standard form is if the publisher decides it wants to give the rights back.
Well, something to watch out for all those people who are thinking about, you know, their dream is to sign a contract with a major publisher. You
Right.
know, maybe it's a good idea. Maybe not a good idea for everybody.
You know, authors are different.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody, you know, you can't sort of say, all right, well, this is the cookie cutter thing that every author ought to do, because authors are different. And even though I find a lot of things to like about indie publishing, there are also some very, very strong benefits to a well-crafted relationship with a big publisher, depending upon the author, depending upon the property. And so it's not, you know, it's for me, it's not a religious war. It's just strictly pragmatically, what is best for the author today? Does the author care more about today or this year or next year than the author cares about 20 years from now? If so, then the long-term commitments that are involved in traditional publishing contracts may not bother one author. On the other hand, for another, it may be something that's really significant. So you can't say there's a one-size-fits-all solution for authors these days.
Sure, and books themselves are very different. Authors are very different, and then the publishing circumstances are, you know, really unknown until you publish the book. And, you know, I'm not, as you know, I'm totally uninterested in the religious wars. It means nothing to me, because to me, every book is unique and each author's situation is unique. And there are times when really the best thing would be to try to get an agent and get a publishing contract, because that's what's going to be optimum for that situation. So I don't see anything wrong with that. I mean, you know, most of the great books we've read in our lives were published by traditional publishers and continue to be. So there's no, I don't have any problem with that at all. But I'm very glad, as somebody who's been involved in self-publishing for many, many years, to see that there are more talented writers going the indie route, and I think that's going to really invigorating the publishing business at a time of tremendous turmoil. But I want to get back to your blog, because I'm really interested in the blog. And you know, I wonder if you had a model in mind, or if there was how for the kind of curated content, because there are two things that really seem to typify what you do. One is the curation itself, finding interesting stuff and, you know, sometimes commenting on it, amplifying the discussion. And then the other thing is the volume, because you post many, many articles a day. So, and that kind of goes together. I've seen other blogs that are similar, where if you're curating content, then you can actually, you know, if you had to write a 1,000-word article, obviously you're not going to do too many of those in a day, are you?
Right.
So I wonder if you had a model, or why you decided to do that particular kind of blog.
Not really a model. Basically, the passive voice is sort of a reflection of what I'm seeing and reading in the process of keeping up with what's going on with publishing, both traditional and self-publishing, as I go through the day. I've got I follow a zillion blogs with a feed reader, including yours. And then I probably have 50 to 60 Google alerts that are set up for particular phrases or subjects that I'm interested in. And I comb through, and at least for me, I'm able to do so fairly quickly. I comb through a big selection of information every day, just looking for tidbits that are important to me. And if I think they're important to me, then or interesting to me, then I think they may be interesting to other people that are involved in the publishing industry or the self-publishing industry. So it's sort of like one of those big whales that swims around and takes in millions of gallons of water all day just to strain out some algae that sustains them. And I'm sort of like one of those whales with information.
An information whale.
An information whale, that's right.
That's a great image right there. So, it's interesting because, part of, blogging strategy for a lot of people who are blogging with some kind of intent, is posting more often is typically a way to gain traffic. Mm-hmm. And your traffic obviously has been going up, up, up. And your subscribers, and I noticed you're really gathering a huge tribe on Twitter. Mm-hmm. Last time I checked, I think you had about 23,000 followers there. And do you auto post your blog post through to your Twitter account?
Yeah, I do. Uh-huh. They automatically connect up with Twitter. And it's kind of interesting that you mentioned Twitter, because I was a giant Twitter skeptic, and I like a lot of tech geek types. As soon as they opened up, I signed up. I went on, and I said, this is a waste of time. But and I'm still, Twitter is something. I've got a bunch of Twitter people that I follow. That are another source of potential blog posts as well. But it's I'm still not a giant fan of sort of sitting down and reading Twitter, mm-hmm. but I get roughly 25% of my daily hits on my website come when people click on Twitter links. And so from the standpoint of just making it available, getting it out so that people discover the blog, Twitter is important. And I know some of the people that are regular visitors to the blog and regular commenters on the blog, come in via Twitter. They just, they watch the Twitter stream, and if they see something that's interesting, they click on it and they enter the blog that way.
Yeah, and I could certainly attest to that myself. I mean, I've been very active on Twitter the last couple of years, and Twitter is, it kind of is a chicken and egg thing. I mean, I do it because I really enjoy Twitter, and I used it extensively because I find it a really great way to meet people, make that initial contact with somebody that, mm-hmm. and look, I've met people and developed relationships and friendships with people on Twitter. I mean, I could have called them on the phone 2 years ago. They wouldn't have even taken my call, but on Twitter, it's a whole different world. So I love that part of Twitter. And Twitter is the second biggest source of traffic on my blog as well. And I think it's, basically the same reason. Although I think, I like the back and forth more. There's a conversational element that you can get into that's really kind of fun. But, I looking at the Passive Voice as a blog, I mean, you look at a lot of blogs. I look at a lot of blogs. I mean, obviously it's a blog run by somebody who just really enjoys what they're doing. Mm-hmm. I think that comes through pretty clearly. You're very involved with your community. Mm-hmm. You have a active community. I mean, I've had the occasion of where you've posted a link to one of my posts, mm-hmm. and I'll go over there, and you've got twice as many comments on your version as what I've got on the original. So that's really kind of interesting phenomenon. And what do you think about that?
Well, it's interesting. Sometimes, once in a while, and it's, I think out of well up over 3,000 posts now that I've made. And every once in a while, I'll get, I think three or four times, somebody has said, why didn't you just post a link to my blog rather than, you know, pulling out an excerpt or something like that? And it sort of reflects the way that I do things, and I need a reason to go to some new place I haven't been before. I mean, there are, you know, it's like the old Naked City TV shows. You know, there are million stories in the Naked City, and this is one. There are a million blogs that I see links to from time to time, and I only go to a few. And so my idea is, okay, I post an excerpt there so that people who come to my blog can say, oh, that's interesting. I'm gonna go check it out, or no, not interested in that at all. Whereas if I just mentioned a link, you know, like say Glenn Reynolds does on Instapundit, and I'm a big fan of the way he blogs, but I end up clicking through on a lot of links that are not you know, off of Instapundit that are not that interesting to me. And so my style is to tell people a little bit about it, and that may be all they need to know, or they may not be interested at all. And then if they are interested, they click through and can dig deeper into the blog. And I get a lot of people who say, you know, I couldn't fit, you know, my traffic went up through the roof today. I couldn't figure out what was going on. And then I found out, you know, I found out you linked there. And it's a balance there. And hopefully the blogs that I link to and I talk about, get traffic and get a lot of regular visitors after people see that the blogger is doing good things and has interesting thoughts and so forth.
Yeah, and I think that the way you do it, David, is really very effective, because, you know, you're not just pulling, let's say, the first sentence out of the post,
right.
Or you're not just putting in just a link, nothing against Instapundit, that's a different kind of service, but it's obvious that you've looked at it and pulled out the part that was interesting to you. And, you know,
yeah,
whether
that's exactly right.
Comment or
yeah.
not. So, I mean, anybody can see that. And that means that you're dealing with an intelligence behind the, you know, the blog. And that, of course, is very attractive to people. And I think also the general atmosphere on the Passive Voice promotes discussion. So,
yeah.
and that goes down to your ability to both present content and moderate it. So I think it works really well. I'm always pleased as punch when I see you've linked to one of my articles. I have no problem at all. And it's partly because of the way you do it, because you can get a paragraph or two paragraphs, but if you really like it, then obviously
yeah.
you're going to click that link and go through.
Yeah, and that's you do great blogs, and yours is one of the ones that I appreciate the most, and so I'm glad that you feel like it works for you as well as for the people who come to the Passive Voice.
Oh, hey, listen, I'm in the I have the marketing mantra, you know, you are everywhere. So I mean,
right,
I'm spread a lot of places, and you know, that's very intentional on my part. So I don't mind at all. Now, the other thing that's interesting to me about the Passive Voice is it really comes across as a very personal enterprise. In other words, you have no advertising on your blog.
Right.
You don't have, it doesn't seem like you have any affiliate stuff going on. And you don't have an email sign up. So, I mean, you have email subscriptions, but
right.
you don't have
sure.
an opt-in.
But that's just FeedBurner, yeah.
You don't have an opt-in for an email list. Now, those are the
right.
three things that say to me when I'm looking at a blog, you know, somebody's trying to monetize what they're doing or develop some product line or whatever it is. And your blog has none of those. So is that a conscious choice on your part?
Yeah, it is. In terms of sort of, you know, monetary benefits to me, since I've started, I reactivated my bar membership and have started practicing law, I receive a fair number of people who contact me for legal services that say, hey, I saw your blog. You know, others say, you know, I was at a writer's conference and so-and-so, you know, talked about you or something like that. And so that's from the monetization standpoint, that's really the only benefit that I'm uh, looking for out of the blog. One of the big benefits for me is just, you know, as I've said a couple of times, actually more than a couple of times on the blog, the best part of it for me is the comments. Mm-hmm. And there are a lot of really smart people who share some good comments, and I learn things about what's going on in the business. In some cases, I have some very experienced authors who are commenters, and they provide context for, this is what the situation was 20 years ago when I started writing, and this is how it's changed, and so forth. And so, the fact that that smart people leave comments, and sometimes very detailed comments, is one of the great benefits for me about having a blog.
Well, I have to agree. You've got great commenters and a great community. And I know from my point, I love that about blogging also. I mean, that's really where the juice is for me. And then you get these conversations that start up in the comments, and it just,
right.
It's really kind of neat. Well, that's a great segue, though, into the publishing business. Now, we've all been kind of like riding this wave of disruption in the last few years. And it doesn't seem to be slowing down. I mean, formats are proliferating. Nobody really knows, in my way of thinking, exactly what an ebook is yet. You know, we're certainly selling millions of them now, but, it's just basically a text dump from a printed book, most of them, or from a manuscript. There's lots of people trying to extend ebooks in different directions with media or geolocation stuff or personalization or the social reading phenomenon. That was supposed to be a big thing. I haven't seen that happening yet.
Right.
So I'm curious from where you're sitting, because you have a kind of a unique perspective in that, you have this whole intellectual property background. You're a writer, your wife's a published author, and you monitor kind of both the traditional and the indie side. So I'm curious, mostly about the e-publishing revolution. I mean, what do you see from where you're sitting? I mean, we're in a very interesting place right now, I think.
Well, let me give you a little context, because I've seen this happen before. A few years ago, more than a few years ago, I worked for a company called LexisNexis, which provides huge databases, professional databases for lawyers, and on the Nexis side for business researchers and lobbyists and all kinds of different people. And LexisNexis is owned by Reed Elsevier, which is a huge, enormous worldwide publisher. And when I worked there, I saw a number of years ago, I saw the whole legal publishing world, which was sort of invisible to anybody who wasn't a lawyer, but was an extremely profitable business to be in. Mm-hmm. I saw it get destroyed by online access. Mm-hmm. So there was a publication called, well, still is a publication called Martindale Hubble, which is basically a paid directory for lawyers. So if you wanted to find a lawyer in Denver, one good place that you might, and you didn't know anybody there, didn't know any other lawyers there to ask for references, you'd open up Martindale Hubble and read about various attorneys that practiced in a particular area. And Martindale was a big, thick book. I mean, it was at least 8 to 10 inches thick. It weighed a ton. And basic information about an attorney was free. If you wanted to pay for that, you could get an expanded listing, and almost every big firm paid for it, and so forth. That was owned by LexisNexis. Mm-hmm. That the book business, that was an extremely profitable business. Mm-hmm. The margins on that, back in the day, were well over 50%, 50 wow. to 60%, because all you did is collected the information that other people, made available and printed it. Well, I saw that business get destroyed by online legal directories. And, there were people that said, you know, lawyers are never going to give up books. You know, mm-hmm. you go to any law office, you know, and you see row after row.
Have that library, right?
Yeah, yeah. You know, I mean, that was part of what made you look professional is if you had a bunch of books sitting around. Well, law offices still may have a few books sort of as props, and there may be some books that are useful to have around, but that whole business, and as I say, it was an extremely profitable business, just got destroyed by online access to the same information. And so when I look at the trade publishing business today, I see the legal publishing business that I was, when I was at Lexis, I was involved in the first web-based research product that Lexis offered to lawyers. And mm-hmm. so, you know, I just saw that completely change, and it's disruptive change that way. And I think I see the same thing happening in the traditional publishing or the trade publishing world. Everybody said, you know, there are a few people, sort of visionaries, that say, oh, well, traditional legal publishing is going to get destroyed by this online stuff. Mm-hmm. But nothing happens this year. Nothing happens next year. And so the people on the print side are saying, well, that guy was wrong. He didn't know what he was talking about. And then all of a sudden, you know, it's sort of like an avalanche. Mm-hmm. You know, you get a few little pebbles that start going down the mountain. And then much faster than anybody expects, the world changes. And I have no idea what Martindale Hubbell does now. I don't know if they still have a print product at all, but I watched that subsidiary of LexisNexis go from, as I say, immensely profitable, just a cash machine, to laying off a whole bunch of people and trying to, you know, fight for survival when the online, the electronic copy of Martindale Hubbell and a competitor that just sprang up, supported by another big publishing company, just destroyed the financial underpinnings of that business. So I've probably gone on for too long, but disruptive change, and that's, we're looking at a technology disruption here in trade publishing. It, you know, it really changes your life, and nobody can predict exactly when it's going to sort of hit critical mass, but it's always, once it starts, it always it changes things faster than most anybody expects it to.
Sure. And I mean, look at just mobile computing. I mean, mm-hmm. 2 years ago, maybe there really wasn't much mobile computing going on. Now,
right.
If you walk into an airport or a Starbucks or anything, I mean, every single person has got a computer in their pocket, or they've
yep.
got a tablet or an iPad or something. And it was just astonishing to me how fast that penetrated into the marketplace. The thing with ebooks, of course, and you know, more and more people are telling me that they really use their mobile technology for reading books. You know, they're not necessarily Kindle owners or Nook
right.
owners, but hey, they got a phone. You know, it's not mm-hmm. that bad. You can read books on your phone.
Yep.
And, you know, so... the thing is that a lot of these books that are selling as ebooks are basically, you know, and I get interested in this because I have a lot to do with the formatting side, but they're just plain text. You can read a biography, a memoir, a novel, a romance, mm-hmm. and this is the biggest sellers. So, I mean, there's a lot of volume there. But there are a lot of books that are just kind of don't work on
right.
ebook readers. And the technology hasn't caught up there. Now, as we know in the past, you know, wherever the financial pressure is applied, that's where the real force of innovation goes, because that's what everybody wants, is some way to do that, and then the floodgates open. But as of now, I mean, people with illustrated books or, you know, heavily formatted books, or I'm doing a book right now that's like a textbook on insurance. It's just full of graphs and charts and, you know, risk curves and all this stuff. And it would be virtually impossible to produce this as an ebook, particularly if you had to look at it on one of those little screens. You'd never be able to see
yeah.
anything.
So, yeah. Well, and that's, and you would know way more about it than I do, but the whole formatting issue for anything other than straight text, you know, with all of the different devices that that ebooks can be consumed on, you know, that's really tough. And I've seen some ebooks that, you know, where they tried to do some diagrams and so forth, and it just was a mess.
Yeah, it's pretty tough.
And so from that standpoint, you're right. There are some areas that are just not useful at all. But if we look at the internet as an example, I was an early adopter of the internet, and you know, it was just all text all the time. You know, no graphics whatsoever, and then the first web browser came out. I remember my experience with the first web browser, and all of a sudden there was a graphic here, and there was a picture there. It was just an extraordinary experience. As I say, I can still remember the first time, and looking back, it was an extremely crude website. But
That's really, to me, David, excuse me, but that to me is what the ebook looks like now. It looks like, you know, a bare bones, almost like a terminal. You know, if you remember the terminal days, like you know, CompuServe or something like that. That's where it is. But you could see that wasn't really all that long ago. I mean, it's, you know, that's not going to be forever that it's going to be like that. And eventually, you know, it's pretty obvious that a lot of everything is going to be moving to digital. So we're in kind of a strange place right now, and that's presents a lot of challenges for authors. Who are not that technical, or not, you know, they're not in the publishing business. Maybe they have a job doing something and they're an author on the side. You know, and most authors don't actually earn a lot of money from being authors per se, from book sales.
Oh, so you're kidding, Joel. Everybody knows authors are rich.
So. And famous.
And famous, too. That's right.
So what about you? I mean, you're a writer. I mean, are we going to see any books from the Passive Voice? I mean, do you have any plans of publishing anything on the publishing industry, or, you know, that whole contract collection? Just, you know, to somebody who's a publisher, that looks like, oh yeah, there's a book there for sure, you know.
Oh my, a book full of contracts. Only a lawyer could like that, I'm afraid. I actually talked about a long time ago writing a book that discussed the Kindle Direct Publishing contract. That's something that every indie author I know uses Kindle or uses Amazon to publish ebooks, and they've all signed that contract. And I talked about doing an article about, or doing a book about it, that basically sort of goes through and says, all right, this is what it means, because even though it's fairly much in plain language, there are lots of different locations and web and places on the Kindle website that are referenced in that contract and incorporated in that contract. And I wrote about it, and then I got really busy with my practice representing authors and on some other businesses that I'm working on the side, and I let it go. But I just in the past week or two, I've been thinking, you know, you need to do that and just bear down and put that together. And it's just would sort of be a plain English. This is what this really means. This is what as an author, this is what you're committing to. This is what you're supposed to get. This is what you can do. If you don't do this, then you don't get paid this royalty rate. Here's the reason that your royalty statements include a whole bunch of 35% royalty books when you thought you signed up for 70% royalty all the time, and sort of just basically sort of a walk through the contract, a guided tour through the contract. And so that's something I've been thinking that I need to just break down and spend the time to put together.
That would be a great service, really. I mean, I think people would really appreciate that. And, you know, having your expert opinion on it would be invaluable, because also you have a way of explaining things that really connects with people. So that's great.
No, thank you.
And what about the blog? I mean, do you have any, as you could tell, I'm kind of drawing to a close here. I don't want to take up any more of your time, but do you have any plans for the blog? You're just going to keep going with what you're doing, or is there anything in the offing that we should know about?
You know, I'm sort of an ADD kind of guy, and so I wish I could say that I have a master plan for the past voice, but right now I expect I'll continue to I'll continue it the way that I have been doing it in the past. It was interesting for me to see my wife and I took the first real vacation that I've been on for 2, 3, maybe 4 years earlier this summer, and I asked some of the people who are regular commenters there to take over as guest bloggers, and while I was not going to be able to pay attention to the blog, and I really liked some of the things they did, and so I don't know about, you know, I thought a little bit about turning it into a blog with guest bloggers from time to time, or probably not a group blog, but maybe. But that's pretty much just, you know, stuff that's floated through my mind without really turning into any sort of a master plan.
So basically, we can look forward to more of the same great stuff that you're bringing us every day, and keeping us up to date on what's going on in the publishing industry, and inserting a little snark here or there where it's called for. Just before we end, I wonder, I mean, you know, your wife is now an indie author, right?
Right.
And you write about it a lot. And, you know, my readers and the people watching this video are largely either authors who have already self-published or are thinking about it, because that's my territory. Mm-hmm. So I just wonder, you know, from your vantage point sitting there over at the Passive Voice blog, if you have any tips or suggestions or things you see that, you know, would really benefit authors thinking about going indie?
Number one, it's not hard. It requires a little bit of knowledge. It requires learning some things that you may not have done before. But, you know, it's not this giant, difficult thing. I have a little bit of technical aptitude, which has been able to help with my wife. But you can hire somebody, if you have no technical aptitude in terms of formatting it, you can hire somebody like you, Joel, to help out with, you know, turning your book into something that will work as an ebook and work on as a print-on-demand book. And my wife's experience, and she had a very good relationship with her publisher, but she just loves being able to control everything.
Mm-hmm.
She actually used for one of her indie books, she actually hired the woman that was her editor for many years with her publisher to do some editing, and Gigi, my wife, said you know, that after she got the editor's comments and changes and so forth, she said the editor was shocked when the book was published a week later. And available, because, you know, as you know, in the traditional publisher, it's sort of, you know, when the editor is finished, you're looking at least several months before anything is ready for sale. And so being able to move fast, being able to, unlike with a traditional publisher, if you find, you know, if you find some mistakes, she loves being able to fix mistakes, because she, you know, she hates the idea of something being out there with a grammatical error or something like that. And so it's not unusual, you know, after one of, you know, her books are proofed and edited and proofed and all of that, but they go up and then she says, oh no, I saw there was a problem on page, you know, 213. She loves that I can fix it.
Quickly. Yeah. And it was really brilliant for her to go back and hire her editor. That's really a great move.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
This has been really, really interesting, David. I'm just really glad that you said yes to this interview request and sat down to talk. I mean, it's just fantastic. And I really want to thank you for doing the Passive Voice blog. I mean, I read it every day, and I know thousands of other people do. And it's just a great resource. And it's because of your curation and knowledge and humor and also your humanity. So I want to thank you for doing that, and I hope you keep doing it because we love it.
Thank you so much, Joel. I've really enjoyed our conversation.
Good.